Only after Thompson reported the massacre to his superiors were ceasefire orders given. For his dramatic intervention and the media coverage it received, Thompson became persona non grata in the military, and for punishment was required to fly the most dangerous helicopter missions again and again. He was shot down 5 times, breaking his backbone and suffering lasting psychological scars from his nightmare experience. It took 30 years before the military recognized his heroic deeds and those of his companions, Glenn Andreotta and Lawrence Colburn, with the Soldier's Medal for Heroism, the Army's highest award for bravery not involving direct contact with the enemy. Hugh Thompson died in January 2006. Paradoxically, Lieutenant Kelly was treated as a hero in some quarters, even with a song in his honor that cracked Billboard's Top 40 in 1971. Whistleblowers in the Vietnam and Iraq Wars and Women on the Home Front. Less dramatic forms of heroism occur when an individual verbally confronts a system with news it does not want to hear, in this case, of the complicity of officers and enlisted men in the abuse and murder of civilians. 2 such soldiers are Ron Ridenour, who exposed the My Lai massacre, and Joe Darby, the Army reservist whose heroic action exposed the Abu Ghraib abuses and tortures. Although the officers involved in the My Lai episode sought to cover up the atrocity, Ron Ridenour, a 22-year-old private newly sent to Vietnam, did all he could to uncover it. He had heard about the event from 5 eyewitness accounts of soldiers who had been at the bloody scene, had independently investigated it in Vietnam, and had continued to do so after returning home. Ridenour sent a letter to President Nixon, members of Congress, and officials within the Department of Defense and the Department of the Army, arguing that a public investigation of the My Lai massacre was needed. In his letter, Ridenour made it clear that, "As a conscientious citizen, I have no desire to besmirch the image of American servicemen in the eyes of the world." However, he insisted that an investigation was essential 1 year after the incident. He was largely ignored, but persisted until his righteous cause was recognized. Ridenour demonstrates the principled heroic stance in his letters to these officials. "I remain irrevocably persuaded that if you and I do truly believe in the principles of justice and equality for every man, however humble, before the law, that form the very backbone that this country is founded on, then we must press forward a widespread and public investigation of this matter with all our combined efforts." Following the exposé by a young investigative reporter, Seymour Hersh, who got valuable material from Ridenour, a major investigation was ordered, and its findings fill 4 volumes of the Peers Report, released on March 14, 1970. Although up to 20 officers and enlisted men were identified as in various ways being involved in this massacre, only Lieutenant William Kelly, Jr. was convicted and sentenced for the crimes. Although given a life sentence, his punishment was limited to a light term of 3.5 years under house arrest, and he was later pardoned by the Secretary of the Army. Incidentally, Ridenour went on to a career as a journalist, but he told me in conversation that he always felt distrusted by many people in Washington, D.C., for having exposed the My Lai massacre. By now we know too well the events surrounding the abuses heaped upon prisoners at Abu Ghraib's hard site, Tier 1A, by MPs and others involved in intelligence gathering. This scandalous behavior was brought to a sudden halt when dramatic images of the torture, humiliation, and violence were forced upon the attention of military commanders. It was a most ordinary young man who did an extraordinary thing that caused the halt to the horror. What he did took great personal fortitude, in the opinion of my military contacts, because he was a lowly Army Reserve specialist who put a superior officer on notice that something horrendous was happening on his watch. When Darby first looked at the pictures on a CD that buddy Charles Greener had given him, he thought they were pretty funny. "To me, that pyramid of naked Iraqis, when you first see it, is hilarious. When it came up out of nowhere like that, I just laughed, Darby recalled in a recent interview. However, as he viewed more of them, the sexually explicit ones, the ones showing the beatings, and the others, his affect shifted. It just didn't sit right with me. I couldn't stop thinking about it. After about 3 days, I made a decision to turn the pictures in. It was a tough decision for Darby because he realized fully the moral conflict facing him. You have to understand, I'm not the kind of guy to rat somebody out. But this crossed the line to me. I had the choice between what I knew was morally right and my loyalty to other soldiers. I couldn't have it both ways. Darby was afraid of retaliation against him by soldiers in his company unless he remained anonymous in this action. He burned another CD copy of the pictures, typed an anonymous letter about them, put them in a plain manila envelope, and handed it to an agent at the Criminal Investigation Division, CID, remarking simply that they were left in his office. Shortly after, Special Agent Tyler Piron grilled him and got Darby to admit, "I'm the one who put them in there." And then he gave a sworn statement. He was able to maintain his anonymity until Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld unexpectedly outed Darby during the 2004 congressional hearings on these abuses, while Darby was having dinner with hundreds of soldiers in the mess hall. He was whisked away and eventually concealed in military protective custody for the next several years. "But I don't regret any of it," Darby said recently. "I made my peace with the decision before I turned the pictures in. I knew that if people found out that it was me, I wouldn't be liked." The revelations led to a host of formal investigations into abuses in that prison and at all other military facilities where detainees were being held. Darby's actions stopped much of the torture and abuse and led to significant changes in the way the Abu Ghraib prison was run. But not everyone thinks that what Darby did was the right thing to do. For many, even in his hometown in the Allegheny Mountains, Darby's calling attention to the abuses was unpatriotic, un-American, and even faintly treasonous. "Hero, a two-timing rat," ran a headline in the New York Post. Even those who are not angry at his whistleblowing are surprised that he could be a hero because he was such an ordinary kid from a poor family, an average student, and even bullied in school. Darby's high school history teacher and football coach, Robert Ewing, a Vietnam veteran, eloquently summed up the mixed reactions. "Some people are upset with what he did, ratting them out, and also because of what happened to those contractors, the beheading. They might say what the guards did pales in comparison. But if we as a country, as a culture, believe certain values, then you can't excuse that behavior. If I ever do see him again, I'll tell him I'm very proud. And as time goes on, most Americans are going to realize that too." I helped arrange for Darby to receive a presidential citation from the American Psychological Association in 2004. He was unable to accept this honor personally because he, his wife, and his mother had to remain in military protective custody for several years in the wake of the many retaliation threats they received. Darby was finally recognized as a hero nationally when he received the 2005 John F. Kennedy Profile in Courage Award. In bestowing the award, Caroline Kennedy, president of the John F. Kennedy Library Foundation, said, "Individuals who are willing to take personal risk to further the national interest and uphold the values of American democracy should be recognized and encouraged in all parts of government. Our nation is indebted to U.S. Army Specialist Joseph Darby for standing up for the rule of law that we embrace as a nation." Challenges to authority systems are not gender-bound. Women are as likely to blow the whistle against crimes and injustice as men are. Time magazine honored three such women in choosing its Persons of the Year, 2002, for their bold confrontation of major corporate fraud and FBI incompetence. Cynthia Cooper, an internal auditor at WorldCom, was responsible for revealing fraudulent accounting practices that kept $3.8 billion of losses off the company's books. After months of intensive investigation, often conducted during the night to avoid detection, Cooper and her team of auditors exposed the deceptive practices, which resulted in the firing and indictment of senior company officers. Sharon Watkins, a vice president at the high-flying Enron Corporation, also blew the whistle on the extensive corporate corruption taking place there, which involved cooking the books to give the appearance of great success to cover up failure. The formerly reputable Arthur Andersen accounting firm was also implicated in the huge scandal. An FBI staff attorney, Colleen Rowley, blew the whistle on the FBI for its failure to follow up on pleas from her office that they check out a person whom it identified as a potential terrorist, and who turned out to be one of the co-conspirators in the September 11, 2001 terror attacks. These three women of ordinary demeanor but extraordinary guts and sense risked a great deal in challenging their established power base. Jonestown Heroes. Debbie Layton and Richard Clark were two survivors among the 913 American citizens who died in the mass suicides and murders that took place in Jonestown, Guyana, on November 18, 1978. Debbie came from a relatively affluent, educated white family in Oakland, California, while Richard came to San Francisco from humble African-American origins in Mississippi. They both became my personal friends when they arrived in the Bay Area after having escaped the horrors of the Jonestown nightmare. Both qualify as heroes in different ways, Debbie as a whistleblower and Richard as a Good Samaritan. Debbie joined Reverend Jim Jones's People's Temple congregation as an 18-year-old. She was a loyal follower for many years and eventually became the temple's finance secretary. As such, she was entrusted with moving millions of dollars out of Jonestown to deposits in secret Swiss bank accounts. Her mother and brother, Larry, were also temple members. But over time she realized that Jonestown was more like a concentration camp than the promised utopia where racial harmony and a sustainable lifestyle would prevail. Nearly 1,000 faithful members were subjected to hard labor, semi-starvation, and physical and sexual abuse. Armed guards surrounded them, and spies infiltrated their lives. Jones even forced them to practice regular suicide drills, called white nights, that frightened Debbie into understanding that he was actually preparing them for a mass suicide. At great personal peril, she decided to flee Jonestown and take the message of its potential destructive power to concerned relatives and to the government. She could not even alert her sick mother to her escape plan for fear that her emotional reaction might tip off Jones. After executing a complex set of maneuvers, Debbie did escape and immediately did all she could to alert authorities to the abusive conditions at Jonestown and to warn them of what she believed was an imminent tragedy. In June 1978, she issued an affidavit to the U.S. government warning of a potential mass suicide. Its 37 detailed points began, R.E., the threat and possibility of mass suicide by members of the People's Temple. I, Deborah Layton Blakely, declare the following under penalty of perjury. The purpose of this affidavit is to call to the attention of the United States government the existence of a situation which threatens the lives of United States citizens living in Jonestown, Guyana. 6 months later, her Cassandra-like prediction was eerily validated. Sadly, her pleas for aid were met by the skepticism of government officials who refused to accept that such a bizarre tale could be true. However, some concerned relatives did believe her and encouraged California Congressman Leo Ryan to investigate. Reporters, a cameraman, and some relatives accompanied Ryan on his visit. As he was about to return home with a positive evaluation of what he had been duped into believing were ideal living conditions, several families who decided to defect under his protection joined Ryan. But it was too late. Jones, by now very paranoid, believed the defectors would reveal the truth about Jonestown to the outside world. He had the congressman and some of his entourage murdered, and then arranged for cyanide-laced Kool-Aid to be given to his weary followers. His infamous last hour speech was outlined in Chapter 12. A full version is available online at the Jonestown website. Debbie Layton has written an eloquent account of how she and so many others were trapped by the persuasive lures of this diabolical preacher man. Jim Jones's Lucifer-like transformation from benevolent religious minister to angel of death unfolds chillingly in her book, Seductive Poison. I have argued elsewhere that there are remarkable parallels between the mind control tactics used by Jones and those depicted in George Orwell's classic novel, 1984, that might make the Jonestown phenomenon a field experiment of the most extreme mind control imaginable, and perhaps even sponsored by the CIA. I helped counsel Richard Clark and his girlfriend, Diane Louie, after they returned to San Francisco, having escaped the mass suicide. Richard was a simple, pragmatic man, a slow-speaking but sensitive observer of people and places. He said that the moment he got to Jonestown, he could detect that something was seriously wrong. No one in the Promised Land was smiling. Everyone in the supposed land of plenty was hungry. People whispered and never laughed. Work not only came before play, but also never left time for play. Jones's voice boomed out over the compound day and night, in person or on tape. The sexes were segregated into different barracks, and sex, even among married couples, was forbidden without Jones's approval. No one could leave because no one could figure out where they were in the midst of a jungle in a foreign land thousands of miles from home. Richard Clark hatched a plan. He volunteered for a job that no one wanted in the piggery, which was in an isolated, smelly part of the sprawling compound. The place was ideal for Richard to escape Jones's mind-numbing rhetoric and to seek out a path through the jungle to freedom. Once he had slowly and carefully laid out his escape, he told Diane about it and said that when the time was ripe, they would flee together. In defiance of Jones's extensive spy system, Richard made the decidedly risky decision to tell the members of a few families about the planned escape. On the morning of Sunday, November 18th, Jones ordered everyone to have a holiday in celebration of Congressman Ryan's return to America with the message about the good works being accomplished in this agricultural socialist utopia. That was Richard's exit cue. He assembled his party of eight and, pretending they were off on a picnic, led them through the jungle to safety. By the time they reached the capital at Georgetown, every one of their friends and other family members was dead. Richard Clark died recently of natural causes, knowing that he made the right decision to trust his intuition, his street smarts, and his discrepancy detectors. But most of all, he was pleased that he had saved the lives of those who followed him, an ordinary hero, out of the heart of darkness. A four-dimensional model of heroism. Based on the concepts of courage and examples of heroic behavior presented here, an elementary model of heroism can be generated. Within the overall motivational framework of a particular person, heroism can be described on three continua: risk type, sacrifice, engagement style or approach, and quest. The axis of risk type, sacrifice, is anchored at one end by physical risk and at the other by social risk. Similarly, engagement style or approach is anchored at one end by active, gallant, and at the other end, passive, with fortitude, approaches. On the third dimension, the quest is described as being in service of the preservation of life, or in the preservation of an ideal. Although they are synonymous in some ways, the preservation of life is also a noble idea. The distinction is important within this context. Let's position three different types of heroes in this model space: Nathan Hale, Mother Teresa, and Richard Rescorla. The American Revolutionary War hero Nathan Hale had been operating as a spy in the British ranks for some time before he was caught. While his activities were patriotic, they were not in themselves heroic. Had his clandestine activities gone unnoticed, he would never have become an American hero. It was in the moment of his execution at the hands of the British, a death he accepted with dignity, that he became a heroic figure. "I regret that I have but one life to give for my country," was his classic farewell. In that moment, Hale showed great fortitude, sacrificing his life in the service of a principle. A very different kind of heroism is found in the life and work of Mother Teresa. Her activities cannot be summed up in a single act, as was Nathan Hale's defiance at his execution. Rather, her heroic acts span the course of decades. Her dedication to enable the dying poor to die in a state of grace, Catholic grace, was based on service to a principle, compassion, in which she was actively and perpetually involved, and the sacrifices she made took the ascetic path to glory. Her poverty, her chastity, and her denial of herself for the sake of others. Our third hero to be placed in our multidimensional hero grid is Richard Rescorla. He was the director of security in Morgan Stanley's World Trade Center, WTC, offices in New York City at the time of the terrorist attacks of 9/11. A decorated Vietnam veteran, Silver Star, Purple Heart, and Bronze Stars for valor and meritorious service, Rescorla is credited with saving the lives of thousands of Morgan Stanley employees by his decisive actions. Rescorla defied WTC authorities in ordering the employees in his offices to evacuate, rather than to follow the order to remain at their desks. During the evacuation of the 44th to 74th floors of WTC Tower 2, reports indicate, Rescorla verbally calmed the employees over a bullhorn and told them to stop talking on cell phones and to keep moving down the stairs. Rescorla, two security guards whom he had trained, and three other Morgan Stanley employees died when the building imploded. Rescorla and his team are credited with saving the lives of an estimated 2,800 employees who exited WTC2 before it collapsed. In contrast to the heroism of a figure like Nathan Hale, Rescorla's act was active and was performed directly in the service of preserving life, yet his glory too demanded the ultimate physical sacrifice. Nathan Hale, Richard Rescorla, and Mother Teresa represent different aspects of the heroic ideal. The distinctions among their actions illuminate the diversity of acts that meet the enigmatic standard of heroic. Their actions are mapped onto our model of heroism. A fourth dimension to be added to this model is that of chronicity. Heroes can be made in instantaneous actions, or their heroism can accrue over time. Acute heroism, the heroism shown in a single act, is described in the martial context as bravery, an act of courage in a single combat. In contrast, chronic military heroism, courage that is displayed time and again in battle, is called valor. There are not yet comparable terms to denote duration in civil heroism, perhaps because the dramatic quality of heroism that is demonstrated in perilous situations is not as easily evident in the civic sphere. Among civic heroes, we might contrast a time-limited, situationally specific heroism of the moment, like that of whistleblowers, with the chronic heroism demonstrated by an enduring engagement in service to society, like that of Martin Luther King Jr. Collective heroism as a matter of degree. The solitary heroic figure, like the brave marshal in a Western movie who faces down a band of renegades, is supported, more often than not, by groups of people working in unison in emergencies, disasters, and situations that demand concerted action. The Underground Railroad, which took Southern slaves to freedom in Northern towns, could function only with the coordinated efforts of many people who worked in peril of their lives. Similarly, first responders to disasters are typically citizen volunteers working in loosely organized teams. As the tank man was, many individuals working in collective harmony are anonymous. They brave danger without expectation of personal notoriety, but for the sake of answering a call to community service. A special instance of this kind of collective heroism occurred on United Airlines Flight 93, which was hijacked by terrorists on September 11, 2001. At first, passengers, believing the plane was returning to the airport, followed the norm by staying in their seats. But when some passengers were alerted by cell phone calls about the crash of other planes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, a new norm emerged. A small group of them gathered in the back of the plane and planned to get control of the cockpit. One of them was on the phone with a GTE operator who heard him say, "Let's roll," before he was disconnected. Their concerted action prevented the plane from reaching its intended target, either the White House or the Capitol. That field now stands as a memorial to collective heroism of the highest order. Heroic contrasts, the extraordinary versus the banal. Fame is no plant that grows on mortal soil. John Milton. To the traditionally accepted notion that heroes are exceptional people, we can now add an opposing perspective, that some heroes are ordinary people who have done something extraordinary. The first image is the more romantic and is favored in ancient myth and modern media. It suggests that the hero has done something that ordinary people in the same position would not or could not have done. These superstars must have been born with a hero gene. They are the exception to the rule. A second perspective, which we might call the rule is the exception, directs us to examine the interaction between situation and person, the dynamic that impelled an individual to act heroically at a particular time and place. A situation may act either as a catalyst, encouraging action, or it may reduce barriers to action, such as the formation of a collective social support network. It is remarkable that in most instances, people who have engaged in heroic action repeatedly reject the name of hero, as we saw was the case with Christina Maslach. Such doers of heroic deeds typically argue that they were simply taking an action that seemed necessary at the time. They are convinced that anybody would have acted similarly, or else they find it difficult to understand why others did not. Nelson Mandela has said, "I was not a messiah, but an ordinary man who had become a leader because of extraordinary circumstances." Phrases like this are used by people at all levels of society who have acted heroically. "It was nothing special. I did what had to be done." These are the refrains of the ordinary or everyday warrior, our banal hero. Let's contrast such positive banality with what Hannah Arendt has taught us to call the banality of evil. On the banality of evil. This concept emerged from Arendt's observations at the trial of Adolf Eichmann, indicted for crimes against humanity because he helped to orchestrate the genocide of European Jews. In Eichmann in Jerusalem, a report on the banality of evil, Arendt formulates the idea that such individuals should not be viewed as exceptions, as monsters, or as perverted sadists. She argues that such dispositional attributes, typically applied to perpetrators of evil deeds, serves to set them apart from the rest of the human community. Instead, Eichmann and others like him, Arendt says, should be exposed in their very ordinariness. When we realize this, we become more aware that such people are a pervasive, hidden danger in all societies. Eichmann's defense was that he was simply following orders. Of this mass murderer's motives and conscience, Arendt notes, "As for his base motives, he was perfectly sure that he was not what he called an innerer Schweinhund, a dirty bastard in the depths of his heart. And as for his conscience, he remembered perfectly well that he would have had a bad conscience only if he had not done what he had been ordered to do, to ship millions of men, women, and children to their death with great zeal and the most meticulous care." What is most striking in Arendt's account of Eichmann is all the ways in which he seemed absolutely normal and totally ordinary. Half a dozen psychiatrists had certified him as normal. More normal, at any rate, than I am after having examined him, one of them was said to have exclaimed, while another had found that his whole psychological outlook, his attitude toward his wife and children, mother and father, brothers, sisters, and friends, was not only normal, but most desirable. Arendt's now classic conclusion. The trouble with Eichmann was precisely that so many were like him, and that the many were neither perverted nor sadistic, that they were, and still are, terribly and terrifyingly normal. From the viewpoint of our legal institutions and our moral standards of judgment, this normality was much more terrifying than all the atrocities put together, for it implied that this new type of criminal, who is in actual fact hostis generis humani, commits his crimes under circumstances that make it well nigh impossible for him to know or feel that he is doing wrong. Then came her punchline, describing Eichmann's dignified march to the gallows. It was as though in those last minutes he was summing up the lesson that this long course in human wickedness had taught us, the lesson of the fearsome, word and thought-defying banality of evil. The notion that ordinary men can commit atrocities has been more fully developed by the historian Christopher Browning, as we noted earlier. He uncovered the systematic and personal annihilation of Jews in remote Polish villages that were committed by hundreds of men in Reserve Police Battalion 101, sent to Poland from Hamburg, Germany. These middle-aged family men of working-class and lower-middle-class backgrounds shot thousands of unarmed Jews, men, women, the elderly, and children, and arranged for the deportation to death camps of thousands more. Yet Browning contends in his book that they were all ordinary men. He believes that the mass murder policies of the Nazi regime were not aberrational or exceptional events that scarcely ruffle the surface of everyday life. As the story of Reserve Battalion 101 demonstrates, mass murder and routine had become one. Normality itself had become exceedingly abnormal. The psychologist Erwin Staub holds a similar view. His extensive research led him to the conclusion that evil that arises out of ordinary thinking and is committed by ordinary people is the norm, not the exception. Cruelty should be attributed to its social origins more than to its characterological determinants or faulty personalities, according to Zygmunt Bauman's analysis of the horrors of the Holocaust. Bauman believes further that the exception to this norm is the rare individual who has the capacity to assert moral autonomy in resisting the demands of destructive authorities. Such a person is rarely aware that he or she possesses this hidden strength until put to the test. Another quality of the banality of evil ushers us into the torturer's den to consider whether such people, whose mission is to use all means necessary to break the will, resistance, and dignity of their victims, are anything other than pathological villains. The consensus among those who have studied torturers is that in general they were not distinguishable from the general population in their backgrounds or dispositions prior to taking on their sordid job. John Conroy, who studied men involved in torture in three different venues in Ireland, Israel, and Chicago, concluded that in all cases, unspeakable acts were committed by ordinary people. He maintains that torturers act out the will of the community they represent in suppressing its foes. From her in-depth analysis of soldiers trained by the Greek military junta to be state-sanctioned torturers, 1967 through 1974, my colleague, the Greek psychologist Mika Haratis-Fatouris, concluded that torturers are not born but made by their training. "Anybody's son will do," is her answer to the question, "Who will make an effective torturer?" In a matter of a few months, ordinary young men from rural villages become weaponized by their training in cruelty to act like brute beasts capable of inflicting the most horrendous acts of humiliation, pain, and suffering on anyone labeled the enemy, who, of course, were all citizens of their own country. Such conclusions are not limited to one nation, but are common in many totalitarian regimes. We studied violence workers in Brazil, policemen who tortured and murdered other Brazilian citizens for the ruling military junta. They, too, were ordinary men, based on all the evidence we could amass. On the banality of heroism. We may now entertain the notion that most people who become perpetrators of evil deeds are directly comparable to those who become perpetrators of heroic deeds, alike in being just ordinary, average people. The banality of evil shares much with the banality of heroism. Neither attribute is the direct consequence of unique dispositional tendencies. There are no special inner attributes of either pathology or goodness residing within the human psyche or the human genome. Both conditions emerge in particular situations at particular times when situational forces play a compelling role in moving particular individuals across a decisional line from inaction to action. There is a decisive decisional moment when a person is caught up in a vector of forces that emanate from a behavioral context. Those forces combine to increase the probability of one's acting to harm others or acting to help others. Their decision may or may not be consciously planned or mindfully taken. Rather, strong situational forces most often impulsively drive the person to action. Among the situational action vectors are group pressures and group identity, the diffusion of responsibility for the action, a temporal focus on the immediate moment without concern for consequences stemming from the act in the future, presence of social models, and commitment to an ideology. A common theme in the accounts of European Christians who helped the Jews during the Holocaust could be summed up as the banality of goodness. What is striking over and over again is the number of these rescuers who did the right thing without considering themselves heroic, who acted merely out of a sense of common decency. The ordinariness of their goodness is especially striking in the context of the incredible evil of the systematic genocide by Nazis on a scale the world had never before experienced. I have tried to show throughout our journey that the military police guards who abused prisoners at Abu Ghraib and the prison guards in my Stanford prison experiment who abused their prisoners illustrate a Lord of the Flies type temporary transition of ordinary individuals into perpetrators of evil. We must set them alongside those whose evil behavior is enduring and extensive. Tyrants such as Idi Amin, Stalin, Hitler, and Saddam Hussein. Heroes of the moment also stand in contrast to lifetime heroes. The heroic action of Rosa Parks' refusal to sit in the colored section in the back of an Alabama bus, of Joe Darby's exposing the Abu Ghraib tortures, or of the first responders' rush to the World Trade Center disaster are acts of bravery that occur at particular times and places. In contrast, the heroism of Mohandas Gandhi or Mother Teresa consists of valorous acts repeated over a lifetime. Chronic heroism is to acute heroism as valor is to bravery. This perception implies that any of us could as easily become heroes as perpetrators of evil, depending on how we are influenced by situational forces. The imperative becomes discovering how to limit, constrain, and prevent the situational and systemic forces that propel some of us towards social pathology. But equally important is the injunction for every society to foster a heroic imagination in its citizenry. It is achieved by conveying the message that every person is a hero in waiting who will be counted upon to do the right thing when the moment of decision comes. The decisive question for each of us is whether to act in help of others, to prevent harm to others, or not to act at all. We should be preparing many laurel wreaths for all those who will discover their reservoir of hidden strengths and virtues, enabling them to come forth to act against injustice and cruelty, and to stand up for their principled values. The large body of research on situational determinants of antisocial behavior that we reviewed here, bookended by Milgram's investigations of authority power and the SPE's institutional power reveals the extent to which normal, ordinary people can be led to engage in cruel acts against innocent others. However, in those studies and many others, while the majority obeyed, conformed, complied, were persuaded, and were seduced, there was always a minority who resisted, dissented, and disobeyed. In one sense, heroism lies in the ability to resist powerful situational forces that so readily entrap most people. Are the personalities of the resistors different from those of the blindly obedient? Are they like Clark Kent, whose normal appearance conceals Superman's extraordinary powers? Not at all. Rather, our banality of heroism conception maintains that doers of heroic deeds of the moment are not essentially different from those who comprise the base rate of the easily seduced. There is not much empirical research on which to base such assertions. Because heroism is not a simple phenomenon that can be studied systematically, it defies clean definitions and on-the-spot data collection. Heroic acts are ephemeral and unpredictable, and appreciation of them is decidedly retrospective. Because heroes are usually interviewed months or years after their heroic behavior has occurred, there are no prospective studies of what the photographer Henri Cartier-Bresson might call the decisive moment of heroic action. Generally, we do not know what the decision matrix for heroes is at the time they elect to engage in risk-laden activities. What seems evident is that heroic behavior is rare enough not to be readily predictable by any psychological assessments of personality. They measure individual differences between people in their usual standard behavioral settings, not in the atypical settings that often elicit heroic deeds. Lieutenant Alexander Sandy Nininger is a case example of a heroic soldier who engaged in extraordinarily fearless and ferocious fighting during World War II's infamous Battle of Bataan. This 23-year-old West Point graduate volunteered to go hunting for Japanese snipers where the fighting was most intense. With grenades, a rifle, submachine gun, and bayonet, Nininger killed many Japanese soldiers single-handedly in intense close combat and kept fighting, although repeatedly wounded. Only after he had destroyed an enemy bunker did he collapse and die. His heroism earned him the Medal of Honor posthumously, the first given in that war. What makes this hero an object of our concern is that nothing from his past would have predicted that he would engage in such killing. This quiet, sensitive, intellectual young man had gone on record as saying that he could never kill anyone out of hatred. Yet he had done so repeatedly without regard for his own safety. Had he been given all available personality tests, would they have helped predict this unexpectedly violent behavior? In his review of personality testing, the author Malcolm Gladwell surmises that Nininger's file might be as thick as a phone book, but his file will tell us little about the one thing we're most interested in. For that, we have to join him in the jungles of Bataan. In short, we have to understand the person in the situation. Heroism validates the human connection. For reasons we do not yet fully understand, thousands of ordinary people in every country around the world, when they are placed in special circumstances, make the decision to act heroically. On the face of it, the perspective we take here seems to deflate the myth of the hero and to make something special into something banal. This is not so, however, because our position still recognizes that the act of heroism is indeed special and rare. Heroism supports the ideals of a community and serves as an extraordinary guide, and it provides an exemplary role model for pro-social behavior. The banality of heroism means that we are all heroes in waiting. It is a choice that we may all be called upon to make at some point in time. I believe that by making heroism an egalitarian attribute of human nature rather than a rare feature of the elect few, we can better foster heroic acts in every community. According to journalist Carol DePino, everyone has the capability of becoming a hero in one degree or another. Sometimes you might not realize it. To someone, it could be as small as holding a door open and saying hello to them. We are all heroes to someone. This new theme of the universality of ordinary heroes encourages us to rethink about the common heroes among us, those whose daily sacrifices enrich our lives. Daniel Boorstin's earlier noted cynical view of media-crafted celebrities as heroes gives way before his deep appreciation of the everyday unsung heroes living and working among us. In this life of illusion and quasi-illusion, the person with solid virtues who can be admired for something more substantial than his well-knownness often proves to be the unsung hero. The teacher, the nurse, the mother, the honest cop, the hard worker at lonely, underpaid, unglamorous, unpublicized jobs. Topsy-turvily, these can remain heroes precisely because they remain unsung. And so, the parting message that we might derive from our long journey into the heart of darkness and back again is that heroic acts and the people who engage in them should be celebrated. They form essential links among us. They forge our human connection. The evil that persists in our midst must be countered and eventually overcome by the greater good in the collective hearts and personal heroic resolve of every man and every woman. It is not an abstract concept, but, as we are reminded by the Russian poet and former prisoner in Stalin's gulag, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the line dividing good and evil cuts through the center of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? Thanks for sharing this journey with me. Ciao, Phil Zimbardo. This concludes The Lucifer Effect. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers. Or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog.